Welcome back to our Ancient Mysteries special, Jesus in India, as we start our second part of the interview with Paul Davids, the noted film critic, producer, and writer, about this amazing new documentary film. By the way, it is available as a DVD. Simply go to his website, JesusInIndiaTheMovie.com. We have a link to it from this page where you're listening to the show, by the way. Paul, welcome back, and let's pick up the show with you locating the tomb of what is believed to be Jesus Christ there in India. I mean, it was amazing looking at this part of your documentary. This thing was a glass-enclosed area.
We do that, but that glass area that has a sarcophagus, that is a mock sarcophagus. That is not... The real sarcophagus is down below. It's like there's a building, and it has this subterranean section. There have been pictures taken of the ancient stone marker, 2,000 years old, that marks the body, where the body is buried. And it is in the east-west direction, which is the way the ancient Jews chose to bury the dead. With the Muslims, it's north-south. This tomb predated the Muslim world by hundreds and hundreds of years. And among the Hindus, they have cremation. They wouldn't have a tomb marker like this. So,
speaking of cremation, you have a powerful segment of a burial. The ashes being spread out on the
river. We were on the Ganges River filming for a couple of days, and they do have the cremation ceremonies in the banks of the river there. And, of course, they don't want you to film that. And there are various prohibitions against filming in different places throughout India. Some of them we got around through getting high-level official permission. For example, the Madurai Temple of Meenakshi, it's called Meenakshi in Madurai, to the south in India, is one of the most fantastically beautiful temples that exists anywhere in the world. I mean, I think it's as much of a wonder of the world as is the Taj Mahal, where we also film. But Meenakshi has about 7 or 8 huge towers that are like pyramids that have, each tower has like several hundred rungs or levels going from the bottom to the top, and each one is completely surrounded by hundreds of carved, intricate statues of the mythological figures of Hindu, Hindu faith, all of them painted with dyes, very colorful. This is absolutely one of the most staggering things, and they haven't let Westerners in there for quite some time. There was once a bombing threat there, and they stopped all filming. But when we got there, again, with help through our inside sources, we did get permission to film inside and have an interview with the head priest of Meenakshi, who also insists that Jesus was in India and that Jesus was also in Tibet. Studying with, he says, it was kind of funny in a way, he said, the holiness people that time, and that Jesus took back to Israel some of the unique specific beliefs of the Hindu religion, including love, patience, forgiveness. He goes through all of these and feels that this was part of the Eastern approach that Jesus brought to confront Judaism with at that time. And, of course, he was a very divisive figure. He was either accepted by the people that came to his message, or he was rejected, and in the end, crucified.
Well, there are several versions of Jesus and his ascension into heaven. Some say he didn't die on the cross at all, but went to India.
Well, I'm not going to say what's correct. I'll say what's believed by these theories. But going toward the beginning of the story, you have in the Gospel of Matthew the three magi. We three kings of Orient are. You know, they weren't kings, they were...
Well, what I mean, for instance, the Christmas song We Three Kings of Oriental Art.
That's not in the Bible, but they came bearing gold and incense and myrrh, which were traditional gifts given to esteemed personages in India at that time. And Paramahansa Yogananda said the three wise men were from India. Other scholars have contested this and said they think that they were from Persia. But India, there's been a whole PhD thesis written arguing that it was India. And the claim of Paramahansaji was that Jesus, when he reached the age of about 13, that he essentially returned the visit, the call of the East. Essentially, he had benefactors from the wise men from India. And if he had stayed in Israel at 13, all eligible bachelors, you're a man. You go through the bar mitzvah. You are married. You do not remain single. If he had left, you know, that would be one explanation why he would remain single. Michael Hesseman in the film offers a different explanation, saying that he entered a particular kind of religious community that was monastic. But in India, there's so many documents and stories about Saint Isa who came to them. And the picture that they paint of Jesus, and that comes across in the what I call the Notovitch document, this is the ancient scroll seen by the Russian traveler Nicholas Notovitch and several other explorers who followed him and translated that fill in Jesus' missing years. Supposed to have been seen at the Hemus Monastery. Today they can't produce it at the Hemus Monastery. They don't deny that they have it, but they tell you they don't know where it would be and that they can't confirm it. But all of this points to a Jesus in India who was not complacent, was not just there to study Hinduism, but objected to some of the tenets of Hinduism and violated some of their precepts and actually got into trouble because he did not agree with the caste system. All children of God are equal in the eyes and the sight of God. So how can you have four levels of castes with some being untouchables? And he violated their precepts by taking the holy Vedas to the untouchables and reading them the Vedas that the untouchable caste is not allowed to hear. This aroused the wrath of the Brahmin class, and they were going to arrange to assassinate Jesus, according to the Notovitch, and Jesus escaped. So this is a very interesting picture of a Jesus there that is completely consistent with the Jesus we know in Judea.
So you're saying that you found out that Jesus challenged the religious elders there in India, just like he did in Israel.
Oh, and said, "You will not do this in this house of God." In other words, he came as the law, as the authority. He put down the law, and he did it with the Hindus, and he did it with the Buddhists, just like he did it with the Jews in Israel. So why is this so categorically rejected by Christianity? Because if Hindus, I think, if Hindus were just making this up, if this is just all invented after the fact, wouldn't they have invented a version of Jesus that was sympathetic to them? Of course they would have. Why would they have put forward a version of Jesus who was a troublemaker for them? So I think that has credibility, that he then, the belief is, eventually made his way back to Judea at around age 30, at which time he was baptized by his cousin John the Baptist at the Jordan River. The next 3 years are told in the Bible, leading up to the crucifixion, and then you have this controversy about the crucifixion. Now, in my film, I take pains to provide both sides. I have five prominent Catholics in the film, and a fundamentalist preacher in Texas, explaining about these issues from an Orthodox Christian point of view. That Jesus died, and he was resurrected. And, according to the Christian traditions, after meeting with the disciples, after a certain period of time, ascended to heaven and sits at the right hand of God. There are others in the film, including Arif Khan of the Tomb of Jesus website in London, and Professor James Deardorff, who's written books about this, Holger Kirsten is referred to in the film and contributed some photos to it. He has written about this in the belief that Jesus didn't die on the cross, that it was a near death. It was, 2,000 years has passed since then. 2,000 years of medical history, medical experience, medical knowledge. How many people have thought to have died on the operating table?
Yeah, I know. We get stories every once in a while about someone waking up in a funeral home just before they're embalmed.
So how could anyone 2,000 years ago have determined the answer to this? And so there are those who take the supernaturalist point of view. Paramahansa Yogananda is among them. He's a Hindu, but he agrees that Jesus died and was resurrected, as you find in Christianity. There are others who take a non-supernatural point of view, who said, look, we accept the parts of the Bible that Jesus met with the disciples afterwards, and everyone was astonished to see him. And yes, they all thought that he was resurrected from the dead. They knew that he had had a death sentence. He had been crucified. They all believed he had been executed and buried. And yet they saw him. And you have a gathering of people now on all sides, from Jewish to Muslim, of course the Christians, who are all agreeing now that the apostles did see him. They had every reason to think that he was resurrected from the dead. But was he? There's a Muslim scholar, a great Muslim scholar, very revered in Islam, Shabir Ali, who has just made recently the extraordinary pronouncement that he believes that Jesus did not die on the cross, and accepting the beliefs of those who think Jesus then had a life afterwards. Some say the life afterwards included escaping first to Damascus, Syria, and we all know that he met Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, that became St. Paul. St. Paul believed he was seeing the resurrected Jesus, and that Jesus then, according to these beliefs and traditions, returned to India with his mother Mary. And there's not only the tomb of the prophet, the Rosabal tomb of Yuza in Srinagar, there is about 100 miles away the tomb of Mother Mary in Pakistan, in a little town called Murri, which is named after her. It's misspelled, M-U-R-R-E-E. Some have subsequently changed the spelling to Mary, M-A-R-I. But the tomb is there that is believed by the locals to be the tomb of Mother Mary. And it's protected. It's behind barbed wire now. There's a television tower atop of it. Nobody can really get to it to disturb it.
So it's safe to say that there are some people, especially in that part of the world, in Pakistan and India, that do believe that Mary, mother of Jesus, was buried there.
Edward T. Martin, who is the protagonist in my film Jesus in India, and who has written these wonderful books about it, he first heard about this when he was in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan, and was having some beers to drink in the American Embassy, because in a Muslim country you can't find beer just anywhere, but at the American Embassy you could, and the bartender offered him a Murri beer, and he said, "What's this? This is from Pakistan. Why would it be called Murri? That's an English name." And that's when he first heard the story of the town being named after Mary and that she was buried there. And Ed was so flabbergasted with his fundamentalist Christian background. He said there was only one thing I could do, and that was have another beer. And Strange Bottle of Beer is the first chapter of his book, King of Travelers, and that helped send him on this mission of investigation.
What about the people who say that Jesus got married when he went back to India? And one report already had four children.
We didn't have anything about Mary Magdalene or any of that. Those that say, well, Mary Magdalene there. So you see, Jerry, and I thank you for giving me so much time to explain all of this. There's so much there to this, and it is an extraordinary mystery that I think has major implications for a world today that is so divided by religion and religious beliefs, and every faction believes they've got the answer, that they were born into the one true religion. And, well, there's historic facts to some extent behind what's written, and then there's also legends and myths. And sorting through it all 2,000 years later is a very difficult task. Was he married to Mary Magdalene? We saw nothing about that. There was some discussion that when he was in India later in his life that he married at that time and was a spiritual advisor to King Shalibah.
Paul, it sounds like you're pretty well convinced that he was there, in India.
There is in one of the ancient Hindu scriptures, which I find so hard to pronounce, I think it is part of the Mahabharata. I just can't say it. There is a description of King Shalibahan meeting this prophet from a foreign land, dressed in white, meditating by a lake, and learning about this prophet who, born of a virgin, who preached a religion of peace in his homeland, was persecuted for it, and had now come there. And this prophet told some of Jesus' parables, such as the parable of the sower. You know, when you ask someone like Monsignor Corrado Balducci of the Vatican, he would say, well, you know, they heard all these things later, in later years, after they knew the complete story of Jesus. Falsa, falsa. It's all, you know, made up, and that's his position. But it is a fact that that particular document I'm talking about now goes back to, you know, approximately the lifetime of Jesus. I mean, it would have been something within, 50 to 100 A.D. So there are ancient traces of this. Profound, profound mystery. I invite everyone to see my film, Jesus in India, and to visit our website. Can I say the name of the website?
Please do.
JesusInIndiaTheMovie.com. And when you're there, you enter the site, you'll hear 6 minutes of this wonderful music soundtrack that I'm telling you about, and much of this information I've talked about today is...
The music is incredible, as our audience can tell. We have been using a little bit of that CD, by the way, here on the program. And there are books, too, companion books going with this DVD. I think on the DVD alone you have 80 minutes of additional material, besides the 97-minute film, and then there are the books.
Well, the first one by Ed Martin is the one that inspired the film. We re-edited it and revised it, updated it. It's called King of Travelers, Jesus' Lost Years in India.
Yeah, I've read part of that book.
My
it's
personal
good.
Favorite, because it's about so much about what we went through to make the film, is the second book, which is called Jesus in India, King of Wisdom, The Making of the Film and New Findings on Jesus' Lost Years. And that there, you'll get the whole story of how the film came to be, its origins, our adventures and journeys in India for those 6 weeks of filming there, with many excerpts of what was said in the various interviews, the meeting with the Shankaracharya, what was said at the tomb of Yuzasov in Kashmir. And I wrote the foreword to it, and I wrote an extensive afterword to it, which tells that once we left India, there was another year of production. I went not only to the Vatican to film, I went to London to film with Arif Khan. I was in New York at the Nicholas Roark Museum. The Russian painter Nicholas Roark had painted paintings of Jesus in India. He had seen the ancient documents that said Jesus was there, so the museum cooperated. I filmed at the Self-Realization Fellowship in Los Angeles, Paramahansa Yogananda's organization. They cooperated. They helped so much by providing a wonderful opportunity to interview Brother Chidananda, the head of their publications unit. I filmed in Texas to show the environment where Ed grew up. I interviewed some of the fundamentalist Christians there who felt that Ed was an oddball, who could never consider that Jesus was in India, who just said, stick to your own salvation, just worry about that. I filmed at Princeton University with Elaine Pagels, Professor Pagels, who wrote Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. I filmed at Georgetown University with two Catholic professors. I filmed with a rabbi in Los Angeles who teaches at Loyola. You see, it kept going and going for about a year afterwards, and the whole story of how this was put together and why it was put together is there in that second book, Jesus in India, King of Wisdom.
Paul, what about people that are dedicated Christians? What kind of reaction are you getting from them about this film?
I think it depends which part of the religious community. I have found that the more open-minded Christians who, let's say, are less dogmatic about their beliefs, have watched it and found it absolutely fascinating. Many, even Catholics, felt they hadn't heard about the missing years. They hadn't even known there were missing years. And it opened their minds to thinking about a part of Christ's life they had never considered. So that's a very good response that has come from many Christian denominations, including some fundamentalists. However, I will let it be known that a religion writer of the Wall Street Journal took a very close-minded attitude toward the film. And without mentioning all of the great people in the film, she said, as far as she was concerned, this was a caravan of crackpots. Well, I just had to throw up my hands in frustration.
That's a good title for a future movie. Paul Davids presents Caravan of Crackpots.
And there have been people who were thought to be crackpots in all of my films, you know, as I said, you know, from Roswell to Starry Night to my film about Timothy Leary. I'm attracted to the oddball who most people dismiss, who has something wonderful to say. And in this case, and he'll be the first to admit it, Edward T. Martin, the author, is my beloved oddball. He's crackpot number one. But crackpot, the other crackpot, of course, Jesus in his own day was completely rejected and by most of the Jewish population of Israel. And he was considered the crackpot. But was he the crackpot or was he, in fact, the cornerstone? Well, the 2,000 years has proven, regardless of what religion you subscribe to, he was the cornerstone. He built a foundation that has grown and spread and had an influence on mankind unlike any other. That's why we're still grappling with it today. So I invite Christians of every persuasion to take a look at this film and consider it. I'm not asking you to believe it. This is not a film is not a diatribe. It's a discussion. It's a consideration with people on all sides of this issue, with many Christians involved in it. The New York Times said, in this film, Paul Davids sifts through the legends and the myths and the evidence that Jesus was in India. So it's a sifting process, and you can't sift through it all if you're going to run and hide from the fact that there's some people that think that Jesus survived the crucifixion. You need to hear what they have to say, and then decide whether you think that they're crackpots or whether have evidence for their position. You will see there is evidence for their position. You'll see what it is. You don't have.
Paul, you like to make documentaries, don't you?
I do. I've made four of them now.
Seems to me making a documentary might even be tougher than doing a regular movie.
It is tougher because you're always open to the whims of fate, and you never know exactly what's going to happen that's going to end up in your film. When you're doing a dramatic film, you have an approved script, like when we did Roswell. Every word was scripted, and you have actors who are reading the prearranged lines. And when you bring in an editor, he knows the order the scenes are going together in. But in a documentary, it's life itself that you're filming. You're living an experience, and you're filming, in this case, it was 150 hours. When I did the Sci-Fi Boys about Forrest J. Ackerman and Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, in a previous interview, you told me you did about 100 hours of video for the Sci-Fi Boys.
When I did Timothy Leary, I had 100 hours. And you begin in the editing room, and that's why you have to sit there for a year or a year and a half. You have to find your movie within that massive amount of material. You have to boil it down to the core essence of the experience that you want everybody to grasp and to share and to experience with you.
You do good work.
So that's the challenge.
You can tell you love the documentary film genre, Paul. No doubt about it. Everything you do is excellent.
Thank you.
You know, as long as we're talking about this film, Jesus in India, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask Paul Davids about his own personal religion.
Well, I've had a kind of a divergent religious background, just like my fellow producer, Anil Ermeil, who had he had a Catholic father and a Hindu mother raised in India. I was raised by agnostic Jewish parents near Washington, D.C., but my father was a professor at a Catholic university at Georgetown, and he taught at Georgetown, working with the Jesuit priests there and respected by them for 40 years, and he made an extraordinary contribution to the School of Foreign Service. So though my parents were not believers, they really didn't subscribe to Judaism, though that was their heritage. I was brought up in a Catholic community with a father teaching at a Catholic school, always brought up to respect Catholic priests and Catholic traditions. And unlike other boys of Jewish background, I read the New Testament comprehensively. I studied it, read it, reread it, learned many parts of it. I found it fascinating. When I went to college, I took a course in Mahayana Buddhism. And while there, in addition to Buddhism, I discovered Hinduism through the writings of Paramahansa Yogananda. That's the Self-Realization Fellowship founder. As the years have gone by, I've been really closely drawn to the Self-Realization Fellowship and the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. I can't describe myself as a kind of believer who accepts everything. I never would be that. But he taught yoga and meditation in a very practical way that didn't require supernatural beliefs. And I happen to live close to the Mother Center of the SRF and wonderful relationships with the monks there and that organization throughout my life. So that for me is has been the most fulfilling aspect of spirituality. But I'm still a seeker. And I'll be the first to admit I don't
have
any final answers.
And what about Edward T. Martin and his religion? I have met him. Nice guy. We talked a little bit about his growing up in Texas to a church family, going to church every time the church house door opened. What does he believe these days?
Ed, who was raised a fundamentalist, has always continued to consider himself a Christian and a believer in Jesus' divinity, even though he accepts the Ahmadiyya Muslim point of view that Jesus did survive the crucifixion. But Ed says that was still a miracle. That's still reason enough to celebrate Easter. So he celebrates Easter and Christmas and all of the Christian traditions. He also has, though, grown close to the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda, and I think often goes to meditate.
I know you're naturally out promoting this film right now, but what else do you have in store? I mean, what some of the projects you're working on, if you are? Do you have anything in the future?
You wait for funding on things for so long. I had a lot of fun with a Christmas book that I wrote with one of my producers, Robert Rotstand Jr., and we call it Just Be Claus, I Love You. And that word Claus, of course, stands out in red, and everything else is in green. Not quite published yet, but I drew all the pictures for it. I'm an artist, and I drew these pictures of all the characters, and it's a Christmas love story set in Greenwich Village. And there's a few others. There's a feature animation project that I'm looking to do that has music from Nashville. And there is also, I'll tell everyone about this, they'll be interested. There's a long-lost, unproduced screenplay written by Edward D. Wood, Jr. Everybody knows Ed Wood. You've seen Ed Wood with Martin Landau playing Bela Lugosi. And there's a chance, speaking of resurrection, that we may resurrect this screenplay of Ed Wood, who did Plan 9 from Outer Space. So there you go.
Back to UFOs, maybe. In fact, speaking of UFOs, we'll see you in Laughlin, Nevada, down there at the Aquarius Hotel Resort, and the big UFO conference there every year. I think it's February 22 through 28. You're always there.
The International UFO Congress, and they have a film festival every year and a lot of lecturers and speakers who come in from all around the world, and I've gone there for many, many years. I'll be back this year.
We'll be there broadcasting as usual. In fact, I think you have been going to every one of them, or at least almost all of them, what, 18 years or 17 years, something like that? The very first UFO Congress I think you attended. That was held in Arizona, if I remember.
Yes. Not only was it the first one, but when I got my identification badge with my photo on it, I was guest number one.
Maybe when we're together, we can sit down and do another Jesus in India program. We always have an audience around.
Imagine. I admire so much Bob Brown and the work he's done all these years, his late wife, Terry, to put that conference together. And, of course, his daughters, Heather and Nicole, who work so hard on that conference. I think they do a great job. And I invite everybody to come talk with us and meet us in Laughlin that last week in February. But let me just go out by reminding everybody, it's JesusInIndiaTheMovie.com. Come visit me there.
Paul Davids.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thanks for a great show and a great film. You can get the CD music track, the DVD, with 80 minutes of additional material, besides the regular documentary, and the books. Don't forget them. In fact, go over and take a look at the website. I urge you to, JesusInIndiaTheMovie.com. They have some video there, and lots of material, really. Paul Davids has been our guest. He was on the phone from his home in, I think, Toluca Lake, California. That's where Bob Hope used to live, I think. Our web producer has been Jane Swartley. I'm Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening. Good night. Until next time, cheers.